Welcome. I'm Hanat Baba, filling in for Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. The value of our national parks is unprecedented in terms of their ability to preserve our beautiful natural land. National park tourism is a significant driver in the national economy, returning $10 for every dollar invested in the National Park Service. The U.S. National Park System controls a large and diverse group of California parks, monuments, recreation areas, and other units. In total, they exceed 6,240,000 acres in California. A recent report from the U.S. Geological Survey found that in 2013, National Park Service visitors spent $14.6 billion in what are called local gateway regions. Those are communities that live within 60 miles of a park. The contribution of this spending to the national economy is estimated to create 238,000 jobs. In California alone, our national parks attracted 35 million visitors who spent more than $1 billion in these gateway areas. So today, how have services that you find at national parks changed over the years? And what are the economic benefits of having a park in your area? You hear all these numbers. Do you see this happening on the ground? So today, joining us to discuss this is Carrie Cobb, Public Affairs Specialist at Yosemite National Park. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And also with us is Chris Mell, Policy Director at Headwaters Economics. It's an independent nonprofit that focuses on studies regarding economic impacts of land and resources. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Oh, great to be here.
And we want you to join the conversation. What parks do you go out to, and how do you navigate them in terms of paying the costs involved? What have you noticed that the parks are doing to your community? If you live within 60 miles of these parks, what are you seeing change in your community? And which parks do you go to? You can also just give us a call with a shout out to your national park that you go to and recommend it. The number to give us a call at is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Which parks do you go to, and what questions do you have about how these parks are run, where the money comes from, and where your money goes? So let's start off today. Carrie Cobb, I wanted to ask you, California's portfolio of 280 parks, that's a pretty, you know, that's a large number of parks. 26 of them are national parks. So what's the connection between the National Park Service and the state parks?
You know, we actually have a very strong history, especially with Yosemite in particular. Yosemite was one of the first areas set aside for preservation, and that was in 1864 when Abraham Lincoln signed the Yosemite Grant. It was the first time any land had been set aside, and so it was really a landmark bill. Of course, once the land was set aside, and that included Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove, for those people who are interested or who know Yosemite National Park, that's just a very small portion of what we have today. But that those original lands that were set aside was actually given to the state of California to manage. And so, in a sense, even though the California State Park System wasn't actually created back then, the land that we now see as Yosemite National Park was first managed by the state. And so this is actually credited as the first state park. So our connection to each other is very strong, even though we are two separate entities.
And in terms of funding, how does that work? How does a place like Yosemite get funding from both federal and state?
So our funding is actually entirely given to us by federal dollars. Of course, it is supplemented by nonprofit organizations like Yosemite Conservancy and private donations, but Yosemite National Park is entirely funded by the federal government. So our funding for state parks and for federal parks like Yosemite is different.
Okay, so let's stay on Yosemite then. It celebrated its 150th anniversary last month, and it gets almost 4 million visitors each year. So how does Yosemite approach the challenge of protecting nature in the park with that kind of popularity and all these people coming in every year?
It's a really, really good question. So Yosemite, as you said, sees approximately 4 million visitors every year. That's a lot of visitors that come to the park, and the majority of our visitors come during the summer months. So late May to early September is when we see most of our visitation. For instance, in July and August, we can see up to 600,000 to 700,000 visitors per month, and that's a huge number to deal with. Luckily, Yosemite is a very big park, and of course, you know, Yosemite Valley is the most well-known part of the park, so we estimate that 75% of our visitors come to Yosemite Valley at some point along their stay. The important thing to remember is that Yosemite Valley is literally only 3% of the entire park. So Yosemite National Park as a whole is the size of the state of Rhode Island, so it's a pretty big park. Now, managing all those visitors is definitely a challenge that we as a National Park Service have to find a balance. With that many visitors, you're going to see the impacts. You're going to see the social trails. You're going to see that the cars pull off on the side of the roads and create larger turnouts, and the meadows get smaller and smaller. So that question it's a very broad question. We've done just a number of things, and I'll try to keep it a little bit short so that you can continue asking questions. But one of the big things we've done, and it's very simple, is we've actually put roadblocks along the side of the road. We've put large boulders along the side of the road and along the side of meadows that are sensitive to people pulling out. What that does is it creates a barrier. People can't pull out into the meadows and onto that sensitive vegetation, and therefore our meadows stay healthy and don't continue to get crushed by the cars. In addition, we have a free shuttle system that goes around Yosemite Valley and other parts of Yosemite National Park. We encourage people to park their cars. So less cars on the road, less impact to the resources, less smog. It helps with air quality. It helps with people's experience, and it helps lessen the impact if everybody is on those free shuttles. So those are just two very, very small ways in which we can still provide for the visitors while they're here, but still protect our resources.
Right. And as we see the wildfires happening in Northern California, Southern California, so last year we saw the third largest wildfire in California history, and the largest recorded in Sierra Nevada. So how do natural disasters like that Yosemite fire, how do they affect the amount of money coming into and around the park, and of course, the visitors coming into the park? What do those things do?
Anytime you have something like the Rim Fire, which was just over 270,000 acres total, with 70,000 of that being within park boundaries, most of it actually outside of the park onto forest land. Anytime you have something like that, you're of course going to see impacts. During that specific fire, we actually ended up having to close two major roads that came into the park, and that cut off a very large portion of the state of California, and specifically our gateway communities of Lee Vining on the east side of the Sierra Nevada, and Groveland, which is just outside of our Big Oak Flat entrance, or our northern entrance into the park. And, these communities definitely feel it. They feel it because people go around, they go through different entrances, and so they don't have the people coming through and buying gas and potentially staying in their hotels and going to their grocery stores. And unfortunately, with a place like Yosemite, where if one of our entrances is closed, we have other entrances for people to come into. And so the impact to the park specifically is felt a lot less than it is for our gateway communities. And that's just one of the unfortunate things about tourism and how these disasters can really affect tourism. Although there's some really good things about tourism, which I'm assuming we'll get to later in this interview, these natural disasters really can have devastating effects on the gateway communities.
California has more than 6 million acres dedicated to parks or monuments or other, recreational areas. So, Chris, Mel, I was wondering, how does this compare to other parts of the country? What is the boost to the economy here in California, in the West, compared to other areas that may have less public land?
It's a tremendous boost. California has some parks that are frankly known across the globe. When you talk about Yosemite, people have that image of the valley and the entrance when they come in there, or Death Valley. You can't go to Death Valley with hearing just a complete variety of languages spoken and people talking about different experiences they're having. And the same is true for Sequoia Kings Canyon or closer to your listenership, the Muir Woods or the Golden Gate Park. Just incredible resources that not only benefit the quality of life that Californians have there as residents, but also bring in through visitation and spending and the jobs they create an enormous economic engine as well. So it's a huge advantage for a California or, frankly, an Arizona with the Grand Canyon or a Montana with or Wyoming with Yellowstone and to have these parks, both to appreciate them but also as economic engines.
Hmm. And the Federal Lands Recreation Enhancement Act, that's a mouthful, is currently up for renewal. It allows national parks and other federal lands to retain fees that would otherwise be directed to the U.S. Treasury. Without this act, the National Park Service, it says, would lose nearly $180 million a year. So are parks and other public resources mostly expected to pay for themselves? And has this changed over the years?
I'm going to give our Yosemite spokeswoman a chance to answer that from the agency point of view, and then I can add some additional thoughts, but just to make sure we get the background or exactly what she'll know more of what's going on in terms of the latest developments in the legislature.
Right. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So obviously, talking about pending legislation is a little bit tricky, but what I can tell you is that right now, we retain 80% of our funds. When people pay, when they come into Yosemite National Park, if you want to come for a week, we have a week pass, they pay $20 per car. In addition, there's other passes you can get, yearly passes, et cetera. But when people generally come in, they pay $20 per car. Right now, we keep 80% of those funds within the park. Those funds that we retain are actually put back into the park. What we use those funds for is we update our visitor services. We update our, such things as like the visitor center or some of our lodging units or the trail system that visitors are on, something that is going to impact the visitors in a positive way. We take that other 20% of the funds and we return them into the National Park Service, and then the National Park Service doles them out to other sites that maybe don't collect funds or don't collect enough funds to do visitor benefits, and it gives them to these other parks to help them survive. So that's what we have right now. It's a program that works exceptionally well, and especially with a place like Yosemite at $20 per car with 4 million visitors, it's a huge portion of our budget, and it allows us to provide those services to visitors while they're here.
That's Carrie Cobb. She's Public Affairs Specialist at Yosemite National Park. With us also is Chris Mell, Policy Director at Headwater Economics. He focuses on studies about economic impacts of land and resources. And we want you to join the conversation as well. What parks do you go out to and what questions do you have about these national parks? And do you prefer to spend time in the wilderness or do you want more amenities like hotels and restaurants in your parks? We want to get to that as well. The number to give us a call at is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And so I want to get a little bit into these, the idea of the gateway community, which is defined as the communities within, 60 miles of a national park. And I want to start with an email that we just got from Laura Pandapas from the Muir Beach Association. And she says, a huge problem facing communities that surround national parks is the utter lack of responsiveness of the Park Service to the concerns and needs of gateway communities. She says there is overcrowding, overselling of tickets to Muir Woods. She says as funding dollars have come increasingly from private sources, the NPS has lost the need or incentive to respond to the actual public. They are the largest landowner in Marin County. And she says, she ends with, they are terrible neighbors. So I want to really get into this issue of when there's a national park and there are communities living around it. Do you hear these kinds of complaints and what would be done about them? Chris, you want to tackle this?
I'd first like to go back to your earlier question very briefly.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think, you know, speaking from a policy point of view and not working for the Department of Interior and the Park Service, I can be a little more free in my comments than the spokeswoman can, but I think it would be a mistake for taxpayers to ever ask our parks to, quote-unquote, break even. We've set them aside, you know, Gettysburg and National Battlefield for historic reasons, or Valley Forge and so on, for part of our history, and then most of the parks in the West, well, there's some historical ones, but they tend to be more of the natural amenities, the beauty of Yosemite or Yellowstone. And that is a priceless asset that we have. And the fact that the Park Service works, in a sense, under a dual mandate of preserving that asset for future generations to enjoy, but also making sure the current generation can get in there, is an enormously difficult and expensive proposition, because it requires an enormous amount of work and study to make sure that we leave it in shape for the next our generation, our grandkids, to enjoy, but also we build the roads and have the facilities for people to get in there. And it just seems almost impossible, if they're going to try and fulfill those goals, which can sometimes conflict, to say you also must break even, especially mm-hmm. for some of the more pure parks that don't get as much visitation. I think it'd be a mistake, or it would certainly harm our legacy if we asked the Park Service to do that. We don't expect our roads to break even. They do in the sense of long-term benefits to us as a community, the same way schooling does or other things, but it would be a shame to say, well, because Yosemite has 3.7 million visitors and it charges X number of dollars a car or a busload, it should be able to pay for itself. I think that would be a shame, because it may work in the short run for some parks, but would be a real problem in the long run for this incredible asset that we have. Now, in terms of how the Park Service gets along with gateway communities, obviously every community is different, and being a Montanan, I have more experience with Yellowstone and Glacier, but I find, and both anecdotally, I'm a city commissioner here in Bozeman, as well as being a researcher, so as an elected official, the Park Service is exceptional. They're a phenomenal agency. They're on the ball. They're very concerned about the communities nearby them. They live and work in our community. They're here in a variety of ways, and they're always available for us to communicate. That doesn't mean I'm always happy with what they're doing, wearing my city hat, but they go out of their way to include us and make sure that work, and they're actually required to do so, but they often go beyond what federal law requires in terms of a cooperating neighboring government, whether it's county or city or some other jurisdiction. So while I'm sympathetic to the concern expressed in the email, my experience has been the opposite, that for the most part it's an exceptional relationship that I don't see why it wouldn't continue going ahead.
And Carrie Cobb, have you heard these kind of sentiments before?
You know, with a park like Yosemite and with an agency as big as the National Park Service, we definitely hear situations like that. And it's unfortunate that this emailer is having those problems with her local park. And, you know, it is something that as an agency, there's certain things that we have to do, and then there's certain things that we do in order to help our gateway communities and to keep those relationships thriving. And Yosemite National Park has a wonderful relationship with our gateway communities. Now, I can't say it has been like that for the history of the park, but it is something that we have been extremely focused on in the last several years. Our current superintendent, who was new a couple years ago, came in and really wanted to focus on our gateway communities, and it's been a priority for the staff. We definitely do everything we can to communicate specifically with the chambers and with the business owners, and we leave our lines open. They can call us anytime they want to. And as I said before, it's very unfortunate that this did you say her name was Debbie? She feels this way in
Laura.
The email. Laura,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. That she feels this way in the email, and it's, you know, unfortunate, but what I can do is just encourage her to reach out to her national park and really try to talk to them a little bit more, and just don't give up, because we do want to hear what you have to say, and we are people, and we definitely try to work with our gateway communities because we know how important it is.
Okay. And again, the number to give us a call if you'd like to chime in with your park that you go to and what questions you have about national parks, give us a call, 866-798-TALK. And we will go to a caller. So let's talk to James in San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, have a good time. Yeah.
Hello, James.
Hi there.
Hi, you're on air.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I had a question, I guess, concerning like the markets and the resorts on the national park land. I used to work and live in Sequoia, and I noticed like this company DNC was, you know, basically running the company, running like the market adjacent to the visiting center, as well as like a couple of the resorts around there. And you know, they seemed like they were making a pretty good amount of money. And I was wondering, like, what does the national park make off of that? Like, is there like a certain percentage that they make, or if they don't, like, is that like a like why doesn't like the national park system service itself like tap into that like revenue that seems to be doing very well for itself while visitors are at the park?
Okay, thanks for your call, James. Carrie, do you want to take that one? I believe DNC also works with Yosemite, right?
Sure, yeah. DNC is also our main concessionaire here in the park, and they provide anything from lodging to the grocery stores, anything, any sort of visitor services they provide. I think, as most people know, the federal government and the National Park Service aren't necessarily set up to provide those services, so we contract out, and DNC is our main concessionaire here in the park. And so I think there's kind of two parts to that question, and the main part of that being, what does the park get from these concessioners being in the park? And yes, the concessioners definitely are running a business in the park, and they definitely collect the fees from visitors staying at their lodging or buying the groceries. But it is beneficial to the National Park Service. So we, and it depends on which park, but anywhere between 9% and 12% of what those concessioners earn within national parks are given back to the park that they're in. So Yosemite National Park does collect roughly about 10% from DNC, and it goes into what we call the concession franchise fee. And that concession franchise fee is given back to the visitors. So recently here in the park, we've actually upgraded the Ahwahnee Hotel in Yosemite Valley. And we've also started upgrading the rooms at Yosemite Lodge to make them just to make them more up to date, essentially. There hasn't been an upgrade to some of these rooms in quite a long time. The money that's paying for that is actually from the concession franchise fee. So we look at that money as something that we can take and we can give back to our visitors. And when they come to Yosemite National Park the next time, they're going to notice these changes.
Hmm. So that was, I hope that answered your question, James. We have many callers on the line, but I just want to say we will come to you in a bit. With me is Carrie Cobb, Public Affairs Specialist at Yosemite National Park, here to answer your questions, and Chris Mell, Policy Director at Headwaters Economics, which is an independent nonprofit research group. And today we're talking about parks. If you go to these national parks, what do you see? What do you expect to get? What do you notice? And have you noticed any changes over the years as you've gone to a Yosemite or Sequoia or Pinnacles down in Santa Cruz and the Monterey area? The number to call if you want to give us a call to ask a question or make a comment is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio, KALW.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the economic value of parks. This is Your Call. I'm Hanat Baba, filling in for Holly Kernan. On tomorrow's show, how can we understand the severity of the California drought? Friday is our Friday Media Roundtable, but today we're talking about the way parks benefit the surrounding areas through jobs and through economic boosts. And we want to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. With us is Carrie Cobb, Public Affairs Specialist at Yosemite National Park, and Chris Mell, Policy Director at Headwater Economics, an independent nonprofit research group that studies parks. So let's go straight to your calls. We have full lines. Let us go to Wanda in Berkeley. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think it's of concern that the private entities are so interested in our parks and are getting a lot of control of the way things are run there. And one of the things, I read an article yesterday in the Modesto Bee about the Nature Conservancy, in that they have actually had drilling on some of the lands that they have conserved. And this is kind of a scandal, I think, in the environmental community. But it is just an example of how some, you know, an entity like that is purported to be a environmentally, you know, helping all of the parks and are actually there for personal benefit or for private benefit. And I think it's a danger that we have with our national and state parks, land grabbing, and also I've heard that fracking is something that's being considered in Yosemite. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Wanda. Chris Mell, private versus public, private things happening on public land.
Well, I'll let our spokeswoman from Yosemite talk about the fracking. I can't imagine.
I'll talk to her about the fracking, but if you can just comment in general.
Yeah, sure. I think it's important to understand that the government needs to be humble sometimes, and that is the Park Service is very good about having you know, rangers in funny hats doing interpretive and educational opportunities or preserving an asset or making sure people can get in to enjoy Yosemite in a reasonable and orderly way. But the government's not set up to be a hospitality service, you know, to provide hotels, food service, and other things. We just don't do that well as a government compared to what the private sector can do. So in some ways, contracting it out and then getting a percentage cut of whatever that person that's contracted with makes a lot of sense, because it's somebody who's got the experience in doing that, has done it in other places, whether it's at a national park or in a city or somewhere else. And it works best for everyone. And as we heard, you know, that money then can be turned around and plowed back into the park so that the resource continues. Certainly my experience has been that the Park Service is very clearly in charge, and usually there's a bidding war for who can provide this service in the park. Xanterra is a name that is often a concessionaire out here in the Rocky Mountain area, and they pay a very high price to be able to provide services. And much like Yosemite, they've also committed to upgrading hotels or making repairs, then that the taxpayer doesn't have to. So while I hear the concern about control of the parks, I think it's a concern rather than a reality, and we have to make sure that it stays that way rather than creeping control. But the Park Service is very firmly in charge of what happens within national park boundaries.
Okay. Carrie Cobb, do you want to answer the question about fracking in Yosemite?
Yeah, and real quick, I just wanted to say, you know, voice my agreement that Chris was talking about, that anytime our concessionaire is thinking about raising prices or thinking about changing its services, it is discussed with the National Park Service, with Yosemite, and if there's a problem with it or if it's something that we cannot agree on, that change does not happen. And so they are definitely very regulated and very respectful of the regulations that are put in place to protect places like Yosemite. Now, moving on to the fracking question really quick, I can assure you that that is definitely nothing that is being considered here in Yosemite. Yosemite is one of the crown jewels of the national park system throughout the entire country, and that is something that would definitely never happen here and is not something that's even being discussed.
Okay, thank you. So let's go now to kind of another area, which is, you know, all of these hotels and motels and these resort kind of, you know, amenities being built in the parks, some people are saying, you know, that versus the wilderness that other people enjoy, are those two things are at odds. And so joining us now is Alan Rosum, Senior Director of Government Relations for Lands at the Wilderness Society. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And wilderness versus, you know, motels and hotels and, you know, concessions. And so what, you know, how, what should we be focusing on?
Well, I mean, I think both wilderness and parks come totally hand in glove. And in fact, most of the parks, and especially in California, the national parks have huge percentages of wilderness in them. Some 80% of the Pinnacles National Park is wilderness, and even more so in Yosemite. So in many respects, they are one in the same. Clearly, wilderness is there to offer a slightly different experience, one that is more primitive, one that is an opportunity to have more solitude, something that I think, you know, obviously many of us need in this digital world. And so the great thing about wilderness is it provides you a different sort of experience, and one that some people who visit their parks certainly want and should be able to have, while obviously the park system runs as it runs and runs for visitor services and for all the great things that the park system provides. Wilderness lets you get a level deeper and really back to nature in a way that many of us may have as kids, or that, you know, gives you a somewhat more outdoor experience.
And do you feel that there is a pressure to build that hotel, or, you know, to build those restaurants in a wilderness area?
I mean, I think there's always development pressure. The, you know, the country is growing, and you know, more and more people want to be in parks and want to be in wilderness. And I think it's one of the things that obviously pressures the park system and the wilderness system significantly. You know, wilderness is a place where people visit but don't remain, and the Wilderness Act dictates that it is you know, that sort of place for solitude. You know, places that are designated wilderness will not be developed in that way, and that's important, I think, to have those places for people to be able to recreate in. But absolutely, development pressures are there in many places, in wilderness areas and parks alike, and it's obviously a constant give and take where we want to be able to have great opportunities to be outdoors and, you know, have development where it makes sense as well.
All right, let's go to more callers. Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. Are you the wilderness kind, or do you want that little bit of luxury and modernity in your national park? Give us a call. All right, let's go to callers. Ahmed in Larkspur, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about just here in the Bay Area, Marin County, San Francisco County. I'm a professional dog walker, and recently the DGNRA has enacted some laws that govern our use of their land. Our city also, San Francisco and some of the surrounding areas have also done similar things, and there's been a lot of dialogue back and forth, and somebody was saying about the National Park Service being a good neighbor. I think for us it's been kind of mixed, because they have the opportunity to kind of have the number of the dogs and the legislation kind of be in line with the city of San Francisco, where the GGNRA area, Ocean Beach, is really not a wilderness experience, like very heavily kind of urban recreation. They've had a chance to kind of make their laws kind of be seamless with the city and the number of dogs, and they've actually made it more restrictive, harder for us. So, you know, that's been my experience, but yeah, it's been, you know, I'm enjoying listening to the show and listening to everything everybody's saying about the Park Service. I think that one thing that did stick out is our nation is growing, and people really do want to be out in these areas. So,
okay.
I would like to see kind of the culture of dog kind of be more represented. I know people have more dogs, spend more time outdoors, and I find the rules over there just in general for national parks and dogs are really oppressive.
Okay, thank you so much, Ahmed, for your call. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Hi, yes, good morning. I just wanted to say that I don't think any sort of commercialization of the parks is justified. What's happened to the Presidio is a disaster with these cavalcades of food trucks coming in and the wealthy trying to drive their way into putting museums in twice, fortunately to no effect. We do have a Disney Museum there. I don't understand why that's in a national park. As far as Yosemite goes, I think that there should be no entrance fees. We have $1 trillion to pay for a rock. Certainly we can provide entrance fees. That's a free entrance. That's a tax on working people. It's a regressive tax. A millionaire pays the same as an ordinary person. And what's done in the national parks also serves as a model in smaller parks, such as Golden Gate Park, which has been totally commercialized. And now no one's going to the Botanical Gardens, formerly called Striving Arboretum, because you have to pay $7. You only see wealthy people in there. And the neighbors used to frequent and aren't there. So I think that the government could have low-cost cabins and so forth. I don't think these high-end hotels have any business being in the parks, but, you know, they have a lobbying interest. The same thing with these nonprofits. When you go to the Mount Lassen Visitor Center, it has extortionate prices for food and drinks, and there's really little value there except for a large wall commemorating the donors to the center. So I could go on for a long time, but I think I made my point.
Thank you, Harry. Bye. I believe our producer just said San Francisco residents are free at the Botanical Gardens, so there's something for you. Chris, Mel, a lot of talk about, leave the parks alone. People don't want development. People don't like the privatization of these parks. Do you hear that a lot, and what has been the response?
Of course you do. And I think it actually ties in a way what Alan was talking about a second ago, and Ahmed, the caller, as well. And that is, I urge the callers to remember that the parks, in a sense, are the crown jewels of a federal land ownership system. And living in San Francisco, sometimes you think of just Muirwoods or the Golden Gate Park, but in a sense, if you leave the Bay Area and drive up to either Lake Tahoe or up to with Yosemite, you go through a series of private land, but then federal land ownership. And the idea is that everyone can see themselves in the landscape depending on the federal ownership. And so on the way to Lake Tahoe, for example, there are forest areas that are clearly multiple use, all sorts of mountain biking and perhaps off-road vehicles and other activities. But then as you get close to the woods in the higher elevation, there are some areas that are capital W wilderness of the kind that Alan and his group work to protect. Where people are meant to be visitors only, as he mentioned, and you have the solitude and a different experience there. And then when you get to Tahoe, you have a recreational aspect as well, and it's more crowded. And something similar around Yosemite, that the backcountry of Yosemite is managed as wilderness. It's surrounded literally by Forest Service lands that is wilderness as well, and so people have that variety of opportunity. And so to say all federal land should be X or all federal land should be Y, I think would end up cutting people out of the system. And one of the great things about the federal land is that everyone can see themselves there and, you know, depending on the experience they want, go to that particular land. The question will be, as pressures grow, what do we do about it? I mean, to compare Yellowstone, for example, where I often spend weekends backpacking or hiking, there are no dogs allowed on the trail, leash or anything. And so the dogs is an issue in a national park and an urban environment around the Bay Area are much different than how they're treated, for example, in Yellowstone. But yet a lot of dog owners in Bozeman go to National Forest land because you can have your dog there. And so, again, it's the citizens knowing what kind of experience they want to have and then acting accordingly to go to different places. And so it will never please everyone, but I think as long as we provide an experience for everyone, it'll be better quality of life, which also then, in some sense, means better economics and better enjoyment for everyone as well.
Carrie Cobb, what kind of things have you heard from the community, from visitors to parks, and how do you respond to them? What do you do?
So first, I want to say, Chris, that was an excellent answer, and it was definitely along the lines that I was thinking. And And, you know, as Chris mentioned, it's hard. It's definitely hard to please everybody. Everybody has different ideas on what a national park should be. And, you know, you have these sites like Yosemite, which is kind of, it's in a very rural area, but then you have these sites like Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is in right in the city. You have to manage those in completely different ways because of where they're at, because of the visitor base, and you have to find ways to accommodate all those lifestyles. So kind of going back to that dog issue, Yosemite doesn't allow dogs on the trails either. You know, I live in Yosemite, and when I want to take my dog for a hike, I have to leave my home, and I have to go to the Forest Service land. And it is one, you know, it's a sacrifice that is made when you visit places like Yosemite or Yellowstone that don't allow dogs. But on that note, there are some people who want to come to a place that doesn't have dogs, and you have to find some way to accommodate all of those types of wants and those types of needs. And in a place like Yosemite, I think we do a pretty good balance of that. You know, Chris was talking about the backcountry is managed as wilderness. 95% of Yosemite is managed as wilderness. And the management of that, those wilderness areas is completely different than, say, the management of Yosemite Valley, which is not wilderness. But if you only have one, you don't have both, you don't have multiple options, you really block off a huge portion of visitors and protectors and supporters to places like Yosemite. So finding that balance, finding the things that people are going to like and hopefully giving them something that they can grab onto, something that they're going to support, really is the only way that we're going to sustain the lives of these national parks.
And I'm just curious, why are dogs not allowed?
So it's, you know, for a number of different reasons. Here in Yosemite National Park, we have a lot of deer, we have a lot of bear, we have a lot of animals that, you know, if you had dogs here, there is the potential for that threat to wildlife. And in addition, with 4 million visitors, that would be a lot of dogs. So the impact to the area, not only on the resources, but also on the animals, would be something that would be definitely noticeable.
Okay, we're getting a number of emails, some happy, some not so happy. Let's do a happy one. Josie Viscardi says, most of my family vacations yearly car trips are involving the many national parks. We camp in a tent. It's especially affordable when I take my mother, whom has she has the Golden Age Pass, like $10 for a lifetime. But I also pay full fees often. We love day hiking trails and see many improvements over the years. Here's another email from Dave in San Francisco, who says, there is extreme controversy with the National Park Service in Northern California with issues around, he says, Yosemite was sued to keep recreation, the long battle to remove the Drake's Bay Oyster Company at Point Reyes. And his question is, does the National Park Service recognize much of the economic boost they're taking credit for is generated by local people who visit these areas? And if so, why are they not working with communities to resolve these kind of issues fairly? So we have a number of issues here in the Bay Area that he's referring to. And I'm wondering who wants to kind of flush out how, you know, how do you solve these kind of disputes when they happen? What do you do? Chris.
well, you know, it's fine. I'll put on my city commissioner hat as much as a policy analyst, in a sense. Is that I think there has to be the clarity of communication and respect, and know that you're all in it for the long haul. I mean, the Park Service doesn't protect land without having a very long range plan for how to make sure that asset is there to enjoy, but also there is to be handed off to the next set of visitors 20, 30, 40 years down the road. And obviously any community leader, whether they're an environmentalist worried about the impact of that visitation or they're the Chamber of Commerce, have concerns as well. And so most often I think it's knowing what's important, trying to find the answers that meet most of the requirements, but also knowing that you should not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, because it's rare when you have such a passionate issue like protecting a place like Yosemite or the seacoast, compared to visitors and people who want to visit it, that you're going to have absolutely everyone see eye to eye. And so how do you find the greatest possible solution? It's really, in a sense, small P politics on a different scale. You know, it's not caught up in the Washington stuff, but it's politics in the sense of people saying what's important to them, explaining why, looking for solutions that meet most of what they need, and moving forward, but also setting the groundwork, I think, of respect and communication so that if one commissioner comes or goes or the superintendent of a park changes, that that relationship endures beyond just personalities and is more systemic for something positive. I think the Park Service does a great job overall. Again, they're a giant organization, and they have, you know, park units and that affect just about every part of the country. So it'll never be perfect just by sheer numbers alone. But for the most part, they do a good job. But I can't imagine that this tension will ever go away, because you're looking at passionate people from all points of view trying to reach a compromise, which is, by definition, very difficult.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Let's talk to Kristen in Muir Woods. Hi.
Hi there. We really need to distinguish between recreation and Disneyfication and an understandable short-term desire for ticket sales by the Park Service. We need to keep that separate from special areas that need our protection. Otherwise, you kill the golden goose. A perfect example is that last week we launched a major lawsuit against GGNRA to get an injunction against Park Service plans to radically expand ticket sales at Muir Woods. They want to shove 1.4 million people through a one square mile area that was originally given to the parks to become a sanctuary. We'd like the parks to pay more attention to their original mandate, which is to balance preservation with access, and in our view, preservation comes first. I'm co-chair of the Mount Town Task Force, which is an umbrella for ecology groups and neighborhoods that care about the long-term future of irreplaceable redwoods and salmon. Our lawsuit is directed first against their plans to build a million-dollar tour bus stop at Muir Woods, right next to Green Gulch Retreat Center, and right on top of the supposedly protected salmon grounds. It may be a financial boon for the Park Service, but in our view, Muir Woods is not worth the environmental risk. For people who don't live in the area, 1.4 million visitors is twice the size of the city of San Francisco. And our question is, how can one square mile of fragile ecology survive that onslaught?
Okay. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for your call. Alan Rosum of the Wilderness Society, tour bus in a place like Muir Woods. So, what should be the response to that?
Well, I think, and again, we get back to this, obviously, give and take as to, you know, what people want from their public lands and different people wanting different experiences. The other thing that we're not touching on here, which I think gets somewhat to that, to the point of the last caller and what we've been talking about, is, you know, the ability of the agencies like the Park Service to have the funding that they need to steward these lands effectively. And Congress has been very tough on these agencies over the last few years as visitation grows, as needs grow, as climate change becomes more of an impact on the landscape, development encroachments continue. And so, you know, the other issue here, which gets to some of the callers, I think, frustrations, is that, you know, some of the agencies are not able to steward the lands in a way right now that provides for all the experiences people want. And you'll never be all things to all people, and I think, you know, Carrie would agree, you know, more resources are needed at these places to help deal with some of these very specific needs that different parks have. And, you know, when it comes to wilderness specifically, you know, obviously that, you know, that's a place where you are going to have that that more primitive experience. But at your typical park sites where there is a lot of visitation, clearly it involves a different level of management, and obviously that's what we wrestle with day in and day out, to figure out where are the right places to actively manage and where are those places that it isn't appropriate to do so. And that will continue to be wrestled with, and something that you know, I'm sure that many callers, that's probably part of what's at the root of their concern.
And we only have a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to kind of ask this to all of you. How can these conversations happen? Today, people called in, people emailed with their concerns. How are these conversations happening between the park services and the people in the community? Let's start with Carrie Cobb.
So there's several ways in which people can get involved and really communicate with their local parks. Now, anytime somebody has a comment or a suggestion, of course, they can go straight to the park. They can do that via email or they can send a letter. And those, you know, Yosemite, all those comments go across our superintendent's desk. He sees every single one of them. And I imagine that parks across the country are very similar. So your comments do get heard. They do get read. And you can determine whether or not you want somebody to respond to you. But even more than that, Yosemite specifically has set in place that we meet with our gateway community members the first Friday of every month, and I specifically do that myself. I sit down with approximately 15 to 20 of our gateway community members every single month, and we have a meeting, and that is one way to stay connected. And then we have another program in which we actually connect with 200 community members through the Yosemite Gateway Partners, and we work with them. We do that on a quarterly basis, and it puts us in the community, and it gives the community a chance to talk to us in person and relate to us and share those concerns. So I just encourage community members to really take an active part in communicating with your local parks.
All right. Chris Mell, just a couple of seconds. Communication.
What she said.
What she said.
It's got to be for the long term. And obviously, they're a public agency, and so take advantage of that. They're going to have, when they make decisions, they're going to do them in public. There'll be many opportunities to engage. Doesn't mean everyone will always be completely satisfied, but continue to take advantage of that opportunity and work with the agency.
All right. Thank you very much. Chris Mell from Headwaters Economics, Carrie Cobb from Yosemite, and also with us was Alan Rosum from the Wilderness Society. Thank you all for joining us, and thank you to our callers and our emailers. Sorry if we didn't get to you. I'm Hanat Baba. This is Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. We cope with extreme drought. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the most severe drought in California's history. Nearly 60% of the state is in exceptional drought. Groundwater reserves are being depleted at record rates as wildfires break out north and south. What can the media and governments do to increase understanding of the severity of this drought? What is the state doing to conserve water, and how much is left? Join us on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.